ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
The FBI illegally bugged him, the CIA is accused of poisoning him, and the NYPD abandoned him. This is the Nation of Islam assassinated him. Hi, I'm James Carlton. This is God Forbid, with the next episode in our special series on religious rebels. We're looking at the faithful reformers and religious revolutionaries who challenged popes and prophets, preachers and presidents, and often paid for it with their life. This week, it's Malcolm X, the African-American revolutionary and Muslim minister. But unlike the other religious rebel of his time, the assassinated Martin Luther King, Malcolm X did not turn the other cheek, and he certainly did not love his enemies. Instead, he urged African Americans and black people everywhere to fight back in self-defense whenever and wherever they were unjustly and unlawfully attacked.
We want freedom by any means necessary. We want justice by any means necessary. We want equality by any means necessary. We don't feel that in 1964, living in a country that is supposedly based upon freedom and supposedly the leader of the free world, we don't think that we should have to sit around and wait for some segregationist congressmen and senators and a president from Texas in Washington, D.C. to make up their mind that our people are due now some degree of civil rights. No, we want it now, or we don't think anybody should have it.
Malcolm X's famous speech, by any means necessary, and less than a year later, he was shot dead giving a speech at New York's Audubon Ballroom as his pregnant wife and children looked on. But if his killers tried to silence him, they failed, because 60 years on, his influence is arguably greater today than it was when he was alive, with countless songs, schools and streets named in his honour, books, films and more. So to discuss this religious rebel who first rebelled against Christianity, then rebelled against the Nation of Islam, we welcome a distinguished God Forbid panel. Damara Payne is co-writer and principal researcher of the monumental biography of the man, The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X. 3 decades of research went into it, initiated by Tamara's late father, continued and completed by her. The book is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, no less, in New York. Tamara, welcome to God Forbid.
Thank you, James. I'm happy to be here.
And Professor Jimmy Butts is a specialist in Malcolm X studies at Trinity University in Texas. His current book project examines the revolutionary form of religion that Malcolm X took over the course of his life in San Antonio. Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, James. I'm glad to be here.
So, Tamara, you first. What place does this man, Malcolm X, have in the life of you and your family?
Both my parents had seen him speak when they were both in college age. He was providing it an answer to the oppressions that everybody was facing. My father was up north, my mother was down south. And so in dealing with what was the life like at that point, and how do you deal with, in Connecticut, you're dealing with really a segregated city up north, and then down, you know, south, you're also dealing with segregated schools, you're dealing with where people can live is segregated, what is Black life like? So who's speaking at that time? And there were a lot of people who were speaking and talking about civil rights and how to fight against this. And Malcolm X rang out to both of them, where he was giving some answers to them that made them feel that this was something they could really work with. It wasn't about turning the other cheek, but it was about speaking to yourself and defending yourself and being proud of who you are and standing in that. So, and my father used to also play Malcolm X's speeches to me and my brothers when I was young, growing up. So he's really in my life early on.
And yet he was a figure in his memory. He is so much larger than life, yet both your parents saw him in life as a mortal, so to speak. Can you speak to that binary, the legend, the man?
He's definitely a figurehead that they see, like a, you know, on a celebrity who's on the stage, right? But they're in the thick of what's going on in the 60s. And they don't know how it's going to turn out. They don't know how it's going to end. But they were attracted to his messaging. You know, how do you stand up as a Black person in this country? And how do you answer to the many slights that you face every day just to get through the day? And also the way he analyzed. And then the other thing of just how we see ourselves when everybody else is telling us that Black people are less than and inferior. And Malcolm X is standing up and saying, no, that we're not. And we should embrace who we are and accept our beauty. So we... Today, looking back on that, he is larger than life, definitely.
To Jimmy Butts now, what do you think about this almost spiritual memory we have of the man? And yet he was a man, you know, as Tamara puts it, at the time, we didn't know what the future held.
Yes, I mean, a lot of figures that would follow in African-American history did not want to touch the living Malcolm X, but some would start gravitating into his direction after his death. I came up in a generation, obviously, you know, after Malcolm was assassinated. And so much of the way Malcolm figures in my life is more so as a image and a symbol first. Similar to Malcolm X, I lived a very rough background as a teenager and did similar things that Malcolm was into during his life. And it would eventually land me in prison, similarly as Malcolm X was. And so being a young man, a young Black male in prison, Malcolm X is seen as this model of what we should do to get the most out of this dire situation. So while incarcerated, I began to follow in the footsteps of Malcolm X by studying and learning how to transform myself by using my mind. This is the model that Malcolm gave to people like me. And it would then only be in subsequent years that I would eventually approach Malcolm as a scholar.
In the 21st century, some people look back at Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, and they secularize them. I want to know, did your journey of intellectual development in prison, was it inherently linked to religious development as it was with Malcolm X when he was in jail?
Absolutely, yes. And this is, you know, part of the reason why I approach Malcolm the way I do and challenge some of these projections of secularism in the life of Malcolm X. So I, just as Malcolm, was able to find a deep relationship with God while I was in prison, which I felt helped me transform as well. And so this is a very, very deep connection here that shapes the way I approach Malcolm X, even in my scholarship. So yes.
On that level, you and he are as one. Through another lens, you are completely different because your two gods are not the same, though. Tell me about that.
This is definitely a debate within religious studies about, you know, okay, do we all worship the same God?
Just to clarify my remark, of course, Malcolm X being a Muslim and you coming from a Christian tradition.
I guess that's what I'm getting at. So this is a debate within followers of religion. Do monotheists, like Christians and Muslims and Jews, all worship the same God. And I think what me and Malcolm X share is that we both saw the one true God as the creator of the universe and the one who created all people and thus was for the liberation and unity of all.
I guess you could make the argument, you know, a segregated all-white church or the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa, which supported apartheid, that was less your God, even though you're Christian, and you were more with Allah, even though you're not Muslim.
I would definitely argue that I would worship a different God than someone who believed their religion supported racism and white supremacy.
Tamara, look, over the course of his life, Malcolm X had four names. Tell me each, if you don't mind, and explain how they represent the chapters of his life.
Beginning with Malcolm Little, son of Earl and Louise Little, born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1925. Malcolm Little, then he converges when he changes his name to Malcolm X. And then after he makes his Hajj, he becomes El Hajj El Malik El Shabazz.
It's not a significant one, but he had, like, a, if I remember correctly, like a kind of street name from the streets of Boston.
Oh, Detroit Red.
Detroit Red.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these are different phases of his life. So, you know, Malcolm Little as who he is with his parents and his family before, I would say, his family is torn apart after his father's death and his mother is eventually committed to an asylum. We have him kind of dropping out of school and you know, starting to smoke weed and getting in trouble for truancy. And he's removed from his family home and sent to a school in Mason to straighten up in Mason, Michigan. And he has a good year there, but it's also kind of like his final year of formal schooling. And then after that, he moves to Boston with his half-sister, Ella. You know, he has jobs. He starts off working with as a porter man on the railroads. And then after that, work doesn't work out, and let's say he eventually lands in Harlem, he's now, you know, hitting the streets and hustling, and that's where you get the Detroit Red persona, which is about, you know, this is, you know, Malcolm from Detroit, where he was actually really born or spent time in Lansing and Mason. And when he goes into jail, he's 20 years old, and then he has to spend another 5 years there. And it's in there where he starts to get this conversion where he's leaving this life of hustling. He wants to change his life. He has this time where he has to sit down and concentrate about what's going on. He's going through this thing of kind of rejecting his family because he's ashamed and he wants to change. He's angry. And he starts to meditate. And then that's also at the same time when his family, his brother, eldest brother, Wilfred, becomes involved with the Nation of Islam and, you know, and encourages his other siblings to join and eventually gets Malcolm to join. And that is where we get Malcolm X, because he's changing, he's taking away his slave last name, family name, and replacing with X, meaning unknown. The last name El Hajj is Malik El Shabazz is after he leaves the Nation of Islam, he's split and he makes Hajj in 1964. And that is the name he has until he dies.
That defining moment in his life.
Yeah.
And if you like, there was, Jimmy, a defining moment in the years immediately before his life, in his parents' life. The America he was born into, the Omaha, Nebraska he was born into, infamous for the Omaha race riot and the grinding poverty that African-Americans face. Tell me about how this would have shaped him.
So we know that the Klan was very prevalent in this area. And Malcolm's family, Earl and Louise Little, these were Black Garveyites. These were people who felt that Black people should have self-determination, who should be proud of who they were.
And tell us who the Garveyites were, the followers of Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey, a Jamaican who would begin or organize an organization called the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And this would be in the early 20th century. He would eventually travel to the United States and set up different posts for his organization, not only here in the United States, but across the world. Malcolm's mother and his father were ardent followers of Marcus Garvey. And so this posed a problem for the white communities that they would live amongst. Because as a self-respecting Black person who is not intentionally lowering their heads or demeaning their own self in front of white people, this was seen by whites as someone who's defiant, someone who's resistant, someone who needs to be put in their place. And so this caused a lot of hostility for Earl and Louise as they sought to spread the teachings of Marcus Garvey and raise their young family.
And Tamara, you mentioned that Malcolm X's mother was hospitalized, sent to a mental institution. This was after what happened to Malcolm X's father. What happened to him?
Well, I mean, I also want to say that as a family, you know, they were a strong unit. While Earl and Louise were Garveyites, Earl would take Malcolm to his meetings, and Louise was very instrumental in the education of her kids and looking over their homework and stuff. So that it's important to understand there was a strong family unit going on here and strong relationships. And Malcolm had a very, you know, strong relationship with his father. His father was very, he was a preacher also, as well as an organizer, and he would use his preaching to recruit people into the movement. And this relationship, you know, is important because it's also, I believe, how we see Malcolm is early on exposed to organizing, as well as giving speeches in front of people, and how you speak and relating to people. And Malcolm X has a front seat to this, and Malcolm Little at that time. Unfortunately, when they move on into Michigan, because what they would do is, as organizers, they would go to different towns organized for UNIA and organized different communities, and they landed in Lansing, Michigan, and they're set upon again by neighbors, and their house is set on fire. And they do experience a lot of tensions in Lansing, especially because the land that they were living on had an exclusionary clause, which meant that Black people could not live on it. They may own it, but they couldn't live on it. And so they are proud Black people, as Jimmy was saying. You know, Earl Little and what he was doing running his errands and preaching. What we found in our investigation with my father and I was that he had slipped on railroad tracks and was run over by a trolley car. And there was questions about his death. And there's still debates. People say that it was murder. We found that it was an accident, and that's what we're going with. But he died. And him dying is a huge flexion point in this family, because he was a rudder for the family. And so now it's like things are shifting. Wilfred has to grow up and take more responsibility in the family. Louise is struggling to make ends meet for all of her kids. And so she's kind of pushed to the brink, you know. And also during this time, you know, kids who are losing this attention from their parents, you know, they kind of wander, and Malcolm was wandering in. He was missing his father and his father figure. Louise also has another child, and the social worker doesn't like this, and she's putting pressure on Louise for having done this. And so, and she can't keep, you know, treading this water by herself. And so she eventually is committed to an asylum. And that's unfortunate. And then what happens after that is that the children now have to be, how are they going to be cared for? Wilfred and Hilda actually continue to run the farm as long as they can. But the other children, they're dispersed. And Malcolm also is sent now to a parochial situation in Mason, where he repeats the seventh grade.
And then when Malcolm X becomes a young man, he, as you mentioned, enters this life of a crime, bootlegging, prostitution, which sees him go to jail. Jimmy, were his skills as an orator and an intellectual present already at this stage, emerging at this stage? And I wonder if there are echoes of it in your experience. Has America changed that much that, you know, you can see the links between the two?
Yeah, excellent question. So this is something that is debated within Malcolm X studies, particularly because when you read the autobiography, Malcolm seems to present himself as someone who had no type of political thought, having lost all forms of what he learned growing up in school. If you just look at the autobiography, you may get the assumption that Malcolm is entering into prison as someone who, you know, is illiterate and completely apolitical. However, several scholars have been able to show that even prior to entering into prison, Malcolm was, for example, a reader. Malcolm was involved in what might be seen as political acts. At one point, when Malcolm is in this teenage phase of his life, when he's still living in the streets, he witnesses a Black woman being assaulted by a police officer. And he steps in to threaten the police officer in order to save this Black woman. This seems to go against the way in which we oftentimes look at Malcolm as someone who didn't really have this race consciousness until after he converts in prison.
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. We're on Radio Australia across the Pacific as well. It's a special series on God Forbid, looking at the great religious rebels of history, and this week's rebel, Malcolm X. We are with Tamara Payne, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of X, and Jimmy Butts, a specialist in Malcolm X studies at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas.
James and Jimmy, I'd like to just add to that, and I think it was wonderful what you were saying, Professor Butts, but in also adding where in Mason, where Malcolm was, you know, when he was in school. And again, I think it's important to understand, you know, how he's getting frustrated with the system too. And he's in school and he was actually elected class president. He was doing well, you know, in school, although he was repeating the seventh grade. But the other thing is that the teacher, his advisor, was asking what he wanted to be. And when he said he wanted to be a lawyer, the teacher said, that's really not what a Black person should be doing. Maybe you should work with your hands. And he really discouraged Malcolm. And Malcolm also kind of saw that people who were not as smart as he was were getting different types of advice, although they were white. And this, again, I think that also is a huge memory and experience that affects him, too. And so I do think that his politics is still there and he's very much aware of it.
I think Tamara is absolutely right, because there's a sense in which Malcolm gives up on the pursuit of what might be seen as a legitimate form or a legitimate pursuit in life. So when he sees that no matter what he does, no matter if he's better than his white fellow students, that the doors will still be closed in his face, that will cause many young people to say, to hell with that. Like, it's no need for me to pursue this avenue if the door is going to be closed in my face anyway.
And this is where his religion meets his revolution. And Jimmy, you say this is a tension, even a harmony, that continues and evolves for the rest of his life, because there's such complementary and contradictory ideas behind religion and revolution. Tell me more.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in my work, I make the case that Malcolm would not separate his ideas about religion from the revolutionary liberation struggle for Black freedom. But the reason why there's a lot of tension and how we tend to think about Malcolm in this way is that we take certain statements that he makes when he is trying to make concessions for his more secular followers. We take those things to be indicative of Malcolm's religious philosophy. So as we know, Malcolm is a Muslim. And one of the main challenges that he launches towards Christianity is this notion that Christianity is the white man's religion, and it removes options for Black people in their resistance movements. And so one of the things that he's most well known for is this question of violence. Malcolm is saying that we should not follow a religion that's going to force us to not use whatever means we have at our disposal to fight for freedom. And so this tension, however, would come up in the sense that while he would see Islam as a religion that would provide stability in the Black liberation struggle, he understood that there were people within the Black community who would not follow him into Islam. And so he would make certain statements and he would develop in a particular way when it comes to one of his organizations called the Organization of Afro-American Unity, where it would appeal more to his secular followers.
And Tamara, tell me about this clash, this relationship between the two great titans of the civil rights movement, the Muslim Malcolm X, and his message of self-defense, of not turning the other cheek, the message of love your enemy, coming from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, the Baptist preacher.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the times that we're talking about America in the 1960s. You're talking about a time when, you know, Black Americans are trying to vote in the South. They're being met with violence by lawmakers who are driving into their neighborhoods at night and shooting up their houses. And they're being blocked in many other ways. And they're being met with violence all the time. And then up north, we have the many other microaggressions and aggressions to surviving everyday life. And that, like I mentioned at the top of the hour, for example, where you live, you know, the North wasn't supposedly segregated. The cities were very segregated. There were Black neighborhoods all over the place. And if a Black family wanted to move into a white neighborhood, they were met with a lot of aggression and protests. So I would say and argue at this point in the 60s that you needed to have both of these messages going on at the same time. And it was really important to understand that you had these options because nobody's a monolith. What Malcolm was trying to do at that time is, what was his role? He was a national spokesman for the Nation of Islam, and he was trying to get the Nation of Islam exposure and on the map so that people understood, because a lot of people, you know, in the 50s didn't know really who the Nation of Islam was until they had this program called the Hate That Hate Produced, which Malcolm X had encouraged and convinced the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to do this documentary that appeared on CBS. And it's at that point where they really explode and you start to see Malcolm everywhere. And he understands that at this point, you really only have one leader of the Black community. And he was trying to put the Nation of Islam and Honorable Elijah Muhammad on top of that over Martin Luther King. So he is going at Martin Luther King like a hammer on a nail. And the other thing is that he's preaching through the messaging of the Nation of Islam, which is Honorable Elijah Muhammad's messaging. And at this point, it's like he's come out of jail. He's moved into this new life. He's recruiting. He's growing this organization. He's very proud of especially because of the elements of self-determination and building up the community. But there are things in this organization that he doesn't agree with.
So, Jimmy, who was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? What was his organization, the Nation of Islam, that Malcolm X became this international spokesperson for? And what was their theology?
Yeah, great question. So the Nation of Islam is a group that would begin roughly in 1930 through the teachings of a man that has many names. Like I remember at the top of the hour, we were talking about the many names of Malcolm, but there are many names of the leader, the founder of the Nation of Islam. So W.F. Muhammad, Wallace Fard Muhammad, but we'll just go with W.F. Muhammad at this point. So in 1930, a mysterious silk peddler was selling clothing in the Detroit area to a predominantly Black community. Through his access to this community, he would begin teaching them that they were not Negro. They were not inferior to white people. And in fact, they were superior to white people. And so this idea was formulated within a theology that the Nation of Islam held, that Black people, that the Black man is God and that the white man is the devil, that God and the devil are not these mysterious, you know, out of body entities, but these are bodied people who are either, you know, doing unrighteousness or righteousness in the world. And so through his teachings, he began meeting in people's homes. He would eventually come across who would become his most important disciple at that time, a man by the name of Elijah Poole, who, you know, himself was a Baptist preacher for a short amount of time. And after hearing the teachings of W.F. Muhammad, he converted to the Nation of Islam. Around the year 1933, W.F. Muhammad would mysteriously disappear. There are many theories about like what actually happened, but the traditional view is that he, you know, he disappears. And now after a power struggle goes on, formerly Elijah Poole, who would become Elijah Muhammad, now takes over the Nation of Islam. And so then he would grow the Nation of Islam. And one of his, the most important texts that he would write that has many of the foundational teachings of the Nation of Islam is in a book called The Message to the Black Man. And in this, he provides a story, a what some people might call a myth of how are Black people where they are today? And the answer to that question is this idea that there is this divine and satanic world that is in opposition to one another. And the reason why Black people are being oppressed is because they have lost the knowledge of themselves, of who they are, and have accepted the religion and the culture of their enemies, the white man. So they've accepted Christianity. This is a sign of their degradation. And the answer that Elijah Muhammad is calling Black people to turn towards is to turn to Islam, turn to your own kind. These are like the essential teachings of the Nation of Islam.
And Malcolm X becomes a son-like figure to Elijah Muhammad and follows his teaching that a white man who's devilish in nature can't become a Muslim, because Blacks are divine by nature inherently. Similarly, a Black man, there's no point for him to become a Christian because it is the religion of the slave owner and the oppressor. This is not an orthodox Muslim theology by any stretch of the imagination. How did Malcolm X deal with this?
Yes, and this, and thank you for this question, because this kind of pushes me into the response that I was going to give earlier, because he sees Elijah Muhammad as a father figure. He is committed to Elijah Muhammad, and he loves him like a father. And while he's in the Nation of Islam, he faithfully teaches what Elijah Muhammad taught. However, I make the case in my own work that even while in the Nation of Islam, there were parts of this theology that Elijah Muhammad espoused, and even that Malcolm would repeat himself, that he did not necessarily agree with. And so, for example, you just mentioned one, this idea that white people are inherently evil. I show in my work that Malcolm never really accepted this particular view, that he gave lip service to it in order to stay committed and stay and continue to have the platform that the Nation of Islam would give him. But you see statements that he would make throughout this time in the late 1950s and early 1960s, where he is making statements like Islam has nothing to do with color. And this is, I'm not talking about after he performs the Hajj, that he's making a statement. I'm saying that in as early as in the late 1950s, Malcolm is already making statements like this. Another aspect of Elijah Muhammad's views that Malcolm did not agree with and caused a lot of tension between them was this idea that although the Nation of Islam rejected nonviolence In theory, in practice, they were just as nonviolent, according to Malcolm, as these other people that they were criticizing. And you see this come to a head in 1962 when a Muslim is killed in Los Angeles, a man by the name of Ronald Stokes. And Malcolm is assuming that he will be able to go out and enact retribution because for this act, because even if you even if we hold this idea of it being self-defense, okay, one of our people, one of our brothers has been killed. So now we have the right to go out and seek retribution. However, while although he was planning, he had a hit squad planning and people in Los Angeles and people in New York ready to go, Elijah Muhammad tells him, stand down, that Allah would take care of their enemies. And so for Malcolm, this was essentially the very type of theology, the very type of religion that he was critiquing Black Christians for. Because even though the Nation of Islam is going to say that, you know, we believe in self-defense, the way Malcolm saw it was that here was an opportune time to demonstrate that particular aspect of their theology, and they failed to do so.
Tamara, one can almost understand this in two ways. Malcolm X ended up rejecting the Nation of Islam on one level because they were too radical. On another level, they weren't radical enough. Am I understanding that wrongly?
I don't know that he thought they were too radical. He felt that they weren't living up to the example that they could be.
Well, insofar as they were Black supremacist, insofar as they thought whites were inherently devilish, as Jimmy explained, he, even before he left the Nation of Islam, had spoken or hinted against that theology.
I mean, I think what Malcolm, he just came away pretty disillusioned, you know, and I understand what you're saying about, you know, with the Black supremacy, but he really became disillusioned because he saw that the value and the power that this organization could be and how powerful it could be. And he felt that, and he said this, you know, a week before he died or was killed, that he believed that Elijah Muhammad didn't believe a lot of these things. And he really became disillusioned. That Ronald Stokes affair, that was one of the last strokes for him. A lot of things are happening at that time, too. You know, the rumors of what's happened with Elijah Muhammad, his morality with his secretaries. There are rumors that he's hearing about that. But also, and I would say what we talk about in our book, the Klan meeting in 1961, when Malcolm meets with the Klan for the Nation of Islam in Georgia. And Malcolm is against the Klan because of, you know, the things that have happened in his life at the hands of the Klan. I mean, they showed up on his doorstep when he was in utero with his mother. And Elijah Muhammad is saying, you know, there are things that the organization wants to do in the South. We want to have businesses. You know, we have to be able to speak with these people. And so he has Malcolm meet with the Klan in Georgia. And this is in 1960. And Malcolm, at this point, he wants to tell them where to go, but he actually does what he's told to do. But it's at this point where he starts to, this tear starts to happen between him and Elijah Muhammad. So it's over from then on that there are more things that happen. And so by the time we're talking 1962 and 63, there's a lot of water under the bridge that he's seen things and he's really disillusioned by what happened with this organization.
And Jimmy, he breaks away with the Nation of Islam. He's perceived by the organization as having betrayed his leader, Elijah Muhammad, you know, who gave him everything that he had. This was the idea, you know. Elijah turned him from a hoodlum into an international figure, almost taking away X's agency himself. He was perceived a hypocrite, which was a very charged term, like being a traitor or collaborator in a time of war. Did this ultimately cost his life? Is this why he was assassinated?
Well, that's at least part of the reason why he was assassinated. So there were many groups on both sides of the racial line that Malcolm presented a problem for.
I mean, the Klan might have wanted him dead, the FBI might have wanted him gone, and the Nation of Islam wanted him done away with. He was not a popular man, except among African-American youth.
Within the Nation of Islam, Malcolm is seen as someone who is going to regulate some of the moral failings that you see within Elijah Muhammad's family at that time. So many leadership positions in the Nation of Islam were held or occupied by members of Elijah Muhammad's family, and they were getting extremely wealthy during this time. And some scholars have argued that this was due to, you know, the misuse of funds. Some of the same claims that Malcolm would make against Black churches and Black preachers taking advantage of poor Black people and taking their money and enriching themselves. Well, these very things he was accusing of Black Christians were actually going on in the Nation of Islam. However, Malcolm held to a very strict moral code. And those within Elijah Muhammad's immediate family who feared that as Elijah Muhammad's health began to decline, that if Malcolm X was to take his place, then he would essentially be cleaning up shop. And what that would mean for them is an end of that cash flow that they were enjoying.
I mean, the betrayal is of a biblical scale, isn't it? Jealousy and lust for power.
You know, jealousy, you know, it tears apart most of these groups. And, you know, when you have people whispering even to Elijah Muhammad's ear that Malcolm X is trying to take over the organization, you know, even from him, and whether or not he's believing that or not, he does make, you know, the decision, because what he's really concerned about is his followers and people following him. And he doesn't want to even look weak. But I would also say that the FBI has also infiltrated the Nation of Islam, has been following and tapping their phones of Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad and other leaders in the organization. And they had been, you know, under the instructions of J. Edgar Hoover to exacerbate this split so that the organization would fall from within.
So, Jimmy, tell me about the assassination of Malcolm X. Who did it, and why does this story continue to evolve even to this day?
To answer that question, you have to answer it in a variety of different ways. You know, if you're asking who pulled the actual trigger, there's one answer for that. But if you ask who were all the people involved, all the organizations involved with the killing of Malcolm X, there's an answer for that as well. So you have this hostility beginning to grow within the Nation of Islam against Malcolm X that would eventually come to its head when Malcolm leaves the Nation of Islam in 1964, when he finds out that he's eventually not going to be let back in. Around this same time period, he's already receiving hostility from local Muslims in places where he's traveling and where he's going, who seem to wish bodily harm against him, because you're having rumors spread by some of the family of Elijah Muhammad that Malcolm, like you said, Malcolm has betrayed the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Also in the background of this as well, since the FBI is listening in, and since other government agencies are listening in on some of the insecurities and tension between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X and his family and Malcolm X, they're also sending or leaking information to the public to stir up hostility even more. So they knew, for example, that Elijah Muhammad was very self-conscious about the fact that when people wanted to hear a speech, they wanted to hear Malcolm, not necessarily Elijah Muhammad. He wasn't necessarily like this great orator like Malcolm was. And so the FBI would stir up that controversy. And then when Elijah Muhammad's health is declining, there's fears among the his family about Malcolm trying to replace him after he dies, now the government agencies are leaking information suggesting that Malcolm is the new heir apparent. So all of these forces are stirring up the pot more and more. But then on top of all of these things, the New York police, as Malcolm is moving forward in 1964, and as the hostility is continuing to grow and grow and grow, particularly when he tells them about the infidelities of Elijah Muhammad, this is what really gets the ball moving forward for Malcolm's assassination. Everywhere he's going, he's encountering Muslims who seem like they are going to harm him. And so he escapes death, or at least escapes attack, let's just use that language, on numerous occasions. And he is telling people publicly that the Nation of Islam is seeking his life. And the NYPD is making light of these threats. So much so that when it comes down to the actual day of his assassination, you don't really see the type of police presence that would reflect a public figure such as Malcolm X, whose life is in jeopardy, present there at the Audubon Ballroom on February the 21st, 1965.
Do you think it was conspiracy or racism or just cock-up?
When we talk about the New York Police Department, they had also a special services investigations unit that had infiltrated his organization that he had formed at that time as the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And they had somebody who was on the security detail who was sending reports back to the New York Police Department. So they knew of Malcolm's movements, and they knew they when they had a sense of when this was going to go down, because the person who was actually serving on for Bossy, Bureau of Special Services Investigations, he actually reported to his boss to say he thought he saw a hit go down. This was a week before Malcolm was actually assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom. And so they actually already had an inclination this was going to go down. It was the FBI that knew, New York Police Department knew, CIA also had tails on him. The day he was assassinated, there were numerous informants from different agencies there calling their bosses to say that Malcolm X had been assassinated. So Jimmy's right when he's talking about who was on the scene. There were a lot of people involved. And then let's not forget that Malcolm X's security team had also been weakened because some of them had been arrested. So he didn't even have the full security team on the day he was assassinated. So it's complex about who was in there, who killed him. But when you talk about the bullet, it came from the guns of, you know, members of the Nation of Islam. And it is understood that Elijah Muhammad definitely sent out an order to have him killed.
And three men convicted of that crime, two ultimately exonerated. They obviously tried to silence him. They obviously failed. Tell me about his legacy, Jimmy.
There were a lot of people who wanted to stand a safe distance away from Malcolm during his lifetime because he was seen as like a person that's going to give you a negative reputation. However, following his death, there would be many young people, particularly those who he was cultivating a relationship with in one of the civil rights movement organizations called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, like it's known as SNCC for short. Some of these young people who Malcolm was trying to cultivate a relationship with would slowly become more and more convinced with Malcolm's approach as the civil rights movement was going on, particularly when you get to like 1964, when you're having the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party being rejected at the Democratic National Convention, when you have the violence that took place during that summer of campaigns that many of these young people were a part of, they were getting more and more disillusioned with Martin Luther King's approach, and they were becoming more and more attracted to Malcolm X. Now, their bond with Malcolm would not be fully realized by the time of his death in February of 1965. However, the following year, you have individuals like Stokely Carmichael, who was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who was heavily influenced by Malcolm X. He is popularizing the phrase Black Power, where young people were becoming more and more aware of the fact that Malcolm's analysis, perhaps, was more accurate than given by King. And so you have groups such as the Black Panther Party. You have Black artists like Sonia Sanchez, like Amiri Baraka, who would be foundational figures in a movement that will be called the Black Arts Movement. Members of this particular movement would all look back to Malcolm X as their what might be called patron saint. And you'll also see this attraction to Malcolm pick back up again when you get to the 1990s, where you have more books coming out on Malcolm, where you have the movie by Spike Lee coming out. And so there's this what's called this Malcolmania that takes place in the 1990s.
Hip hop was hugely influenced in the late 80s and 90s with Malcolm X. And understanding, too, that the rappers, we're talking about Chuck D, we're talking about some of these guys, their parents were huge followers of Malcolm. So that lineage continued, and he had crossed the lines of art and letters.
If he were alive today, would he be struggling still, and against what?
I think he'd be saying the same thing he was saying when he died. I mean, he was laying out where the forces were in the United States, and as far as imperialism, and particularly in Africa, and how a lot of these fights that are going on in Africa are not really between these groups, but they're being encouraged by the colonized, you know, the colonizing forces, and they're still there, and they use divide and conquer, and they're doing that throughout the world. And if he would have looked down on us, which I'm sure he is now, looking at us and just saying, it's continued and it's ramping up. And so many things that he was talking about in 1965, we can look at what's happening. When Jimmy and I have talked about what was going on in 1960s America, we're starting to see, you know, that kind of creep back, certainly with the language and the repeal of the checks and balances in our government and the laws. You know, Malcolm X would sit there and say, look at what the government is doing and how it's not representing you. And how you have to hold their feet to the fire, hold them accountable, and use every power to do this. So he was talking about this then and organizing and thinking about how do you fight against this. He would still be saying that.
Jimmy, you agree his legacy is relevant still?
Absolutely. I think if Malcolm was to see where we're at today, I think his response would be, "I told you so." that as Black people continue to assume that they can tinker with this system and try to change it from within, he told us in the 1960s that it would never work. And so I think if he was to look down on us right now, as we still try to go about it the same approach that we have for decades, I think he would say, "I told you so."
On that bittersweet note, we have to wrap up this episode of God Forbid, looking at religious rebels, the great religious rebels of history, this week, Malcolm X. Thank you so much to our distinguished panel for explaining it so well. Tamara Payne, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Tamara is the Pulitzer Prize winning co-author of The Dead Are Rising, The Life of Malcolm X. And Assistant Professor Jimmy Butts. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Jimmy, a specialist in Malcolm X studies from Trinity University in Austin, Texas. You can follow and share the God Forbid podcast on ABC Listen. Find all the details about the guests and show and the series Religious Rebels on our God Forbid webpage. Email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. Big thanks to producers Beck Cushway and Amanda Roberts. I'm James Carlton. Remember, until next week, be good. This has been God Forbid. We'll be right back.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.